I am Douglas Little, founder, perfumer, and creative director for Heretic Perfume. You are listening to the I Am Heretic podcast. These podcasts are an exploration of the senses with a focus on fragrance, how it's made, the effects it has, and the incredible people it has led me to meet. My guest today is the extraordinary Dita Von Teese, muse, model, glamour icon, designer, choreographer, dancer, entrepreneur, business tycoon, and my very inspiring friend. You and I go back a few years. I believe that we met in 2005. Does that sound correct?
Yes.
Can I just touch on the fact that you just called me a choreographer and what went through my head? It's like, my choreography goes like this. Drink a glass of champagne, go dance around. Oh, it's choreography. I was a little like, unless anyone think this is very serious. I'm a serious choreographer. And also my notes of what my moves are, you know, yeah, I would never want anyone to read those. Anyway, so unless anyone think I'm a serious choreographer, I'm not.
I think this actually opens up a really interesting conversation because, you know, as I'm going through muse, model, glamour icon, designer, choreographer, dancer, I think, you know, the part that for me is the most profound about, you know, us getting to know each other and about who you are, and I think that some people don't understand this, is the entrepreneur aspect of who you are and what you do. I think that is probably one of the biggest things that I wanted to touch on a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, when you say entrepreneur, I think like the person that's willing to make all the mistakes and see what sticks, you know.
Mm-hmm. No,
it's
that's
like
the truth.
That's what I do, is just do what I like and you know, hope that other people like it as much as I do.
Can you take us back? I'd love to touch a little bit on this. How did Dita Von Teese start?
In the early 90s, I'd say, between forging my way as a pinup model and working in a strip club, like the three worlds colliding. Also, loving vintage style. I was already kind of dressing in vintage style and learning about vintage clothes and hair and makeup and getting really into that. And so I think between, you know, working in a lingerie store and then working in beauty, you know, kind of like around the same time, and working in this strip club, working in the LA rave scene, all these kind of things came together. And it was like, okay, I'm going to take these pictures in my lingerie, in my vintage style, like a pinup girl, and then I'm working in the strip club, and then I'm doing performance art in the rave club. It was kind of all these things together and me kind of making my own little career, but not being dependent on any one thing, you know, kind of feeling like I was just playing and it wasn't serious. I didn't have any intention or I didn't think I'd be famous for this. It was just like hobby fun stuff I was doing with my like drag queen club kid friends.
Something you were obsessed with.
Yeah, like childhood, yeah. And it all, I can tell you, all the childhood obsessions that it comes from, you know, wanting to be a ballerina when I was little, being a failed ballet dancer, basically, like loving ballet since I was 5 years old and trying my best, you know, taking part in little rinky-dink ballet companies in Orange County and cleaning toilets in exchange for ballet lessons in elementary school and junior high school. And just never really being that good, you know, but loving it. And, you know, I basically, that's what I did with my dance experience was, you know, I was good with my hands and my head and my carriage and my posture and a good, strong dancer on point, but not good, you know, just not like, and I can't remember choreography. I had to be a solo performer. The universe gave me everything I was asking for in a very different way. That's the way I see it. You know, like I wanted to be a ballerina, but when I thought about it, you know, somebody asked me this. They said, what did you want to do in your life that you never got to do? And I said, well, I always wanted to be a ballerina and I was never going to be able to do that. Because, you know, you can work hard and you can do your best, but maybe you're just not meant for that, you know. You can't, your desire can only go so far sometimes,
right?
Okay, like you can want to be an Olympic swimmer, but you just might not be able to be. But this person asked me, they said, well, what is it you loved about being a ballerina? And I said, oh, I mean, like tutus and that dramatic makeup with the winged eyeliner, like all the hallmarks of the 50s mythic ballerina were all the things I loved. And being in the theater and those heavy velvet curtains and the spotlight and the, you know,
the theater,
the glitz. Yeah. And they said, well, don't you think you got all of those things you wanted? Because you never once mentioned you wanted to dance. And I thought, yeah, you're totally right. You know, when you talk to people that are, they say like, well, I just always wanted to act. I wanted to act. I loved play acting. I loved acting, or I loved singing, or I loved dancing. I felt free when I was dancing. I never felt like that about any of it. I just wanted the outfits and the hair and the makeup and being backstage and, you know, that's what I wanted. So I got all that.
You
and
did.
It was a really important lesson that I went, wow, okay, you get what you ask for, but sometimes not how you specified.
So I think that this brings, you know, the question of, you know, did you intend for this to be a business out the gate? I think
no
that what's
way.
Interesting is that from the outside, when people look at entrepreneurs and people that have been successful with something that's a vision, they look at it and they anticipate that there was a very structured beginning, middle, and end. Mm-hmm. And do you think that that was the case with your career?
Not at all. I mean, I didn't really have any modern examples of famous strippers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was still thinking like, oh God, wouldn't it be great if I could be like Gypsy Rose Lee, you know, 75 years ago. So I didn't think, you know, I didn't have anyone to say like, I'm going to be like her and do this. You know, they're
right.
All dead. I didn't really ever think that I was doing something like that. I was kind of like always keeping my day job, you know, my normal jobs. Because I thought, you know, and also in my like 20 something year old brain, I thought, oh, this is fun. I'm like doing these striptease shows, taking these pinup photos, being the modern Betty Page, taking bondage photos. And it was sort of like documenting the best of my youth or something. I thought I was going to get married and have kids. And, you know, that was going to be my life. Like I thought it was just like a hobby. And it wasn't until maybe like, you know, 10 years later when I was, you know, early 2000s. Getting some mainstream attention from like being on the cover of American Playboy while it's still, well, there were still big celebrities on the covers.
Right.
And
which is one of my favorite issues, by the way.
Thank you. And being recognized by fashion designers and performing at like Marc Jacobs parties or Louis Vuitton and Cartier. Like that was when things started to change for me. And I thought, ooh, I better, this is kind of a legit career.
It's a business.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Business.
I think, you know, one of the things that this podcast is very much about is, you know, it's definitely about people that have marched to the beat of their own drum and certainly about an exploration of the senses. And I think that there's no one that is more sensorial than what you do. It certainly led us to working together and creating projects. I want to really speak about burlesque in the 90s. Did you see that burlesque was needed, or was this just something that you were obsessed with?
It was just something that I was obsessed with. It wasn't really until after I wrote my book, Burlesque and the Art of the Tease and Fetish and the Art of the Tease, and talked about and really explored why I was so into this and how I personally needed role models apart from the scrubbed clean bikini babe supermodel that was so prevalent in the 80s and
Absolutely.
90s. And I couldn't attain that kind of beauty. That's why I looked to the 1940s and 50s. So I kind of wrote about that. And then what happened, which was totally unexpected to me, was when I came out with my book, all these other women and girls and other people came out and said burlesque and pinup is interesting to me too, because mm-hmm. I can be like that too, just like you. So I think like telling my story, it was sort of accidental. I didn't like plan on having like a female audience. And up until that point, I was under the straight male gaze. I was a Playboy model, you know, in the 90s and early 2000s. So that was my audience.
Yeah. I grew up in Los Angeles in the Valley. I always felt very much as an underdog being from the Valley, and now I'm very proud of it. And, you know, having these great aspirations, I, you know, grew up very punk rock and never feeling like I fit in. And, you know, as an adult in my early 20s, and I think when I started to find you, you know, I had reinvented myself and started exploring manners and the idea of being dressed and elegant correspondence and opening doors and all those things, when at that time it was anything but that. It was the, you know, it was the antithesis of manners and being dressed and all these ideas. And I think that, you know, what I really was gravitating towards when I saw your work and I saw what you were doing was that you were bringing back a sense of elegance and style, and you were bringing back a sense of that, you know, that was possible for anyone, you know, that you could achieve this, and that there was something that made you feel very different and very special about it. And I think that, you know, for me, and what I took away from the first time that I saw one of your performances was that it brought that up. It brought something that felt new and unique and different.
Mm-hmm. Well, to that same token, your world appealed to me too, because I always thought one of the biggest questions people ask me with every interview is like, tell me, how can I be seductive, or how do I seduce a man? And to be seductive is really like creating this world of your own that you take pleasure in. And I feel like that's your world too. And, you know, in your home space, like that's, my mind immediately goes there, not to like, what am I going to do that he's going to like? You know, like that cartoon, and there somebody's baking a pie, and then the little character floats up, smells the scent, and like floats in the air to follow.
Absolutely.
That scent. It's like, you want to be the pie, you know, and you're just amazing. And people are like, I need to be near that pie. Oh, I'd like a little taste of that pie. But that doesn't, you know, you have to, if you want to be that pie, you have to be, you know, you have to be like,
you first got to cook it.
You got to cook it.
That's
it takes
right.
time and practice. And to have the perfect practice means doing it every day, you know, and doing that means doing it for you, because you can't suddenly be like, I'm going to be seductive today.
Oh,
and
amen.
I'm going to be glamorous today. I want to do my makeup and hair, and I want this world right now today, because I have a date tonight. You can't. You have to cultivate it. Not just the exterior and the makeup and the hair and the perfume and all that. Read some books.
Mm-hmm. Watch a movie.
Be clever. You know, there's a lot of things that go behind being sensual and sexy and alluring. And it's not just the exterior. It's also the interior and the sense of generosity and confidence, all these like magical things that come together to create a seductive entity.
Absolutely. I want to just touch on one thing quickly before we get into the meat of this, which is talking about fragrance and your relationship to it. But, you know, one of the other experiences that I love, and I don't think I've ever told you this, but one of the things that I love about going to a Dita Von Teese show or a performance is getting the opportunity of interacting with your fans. Mm-hmm. I think that it's something that people don't realize, is that it's so... it's such a shocking experience when you go and you're in the midst of a Dita Von Teese audience, because your audience visually, of course, is so striking and they're so put together and they're so beautiful. But then there's the other aspect, which I mean, for any listeners that have ever gone to a show, you know how rude and fucked up people are, and they're just horrible. And with your shows, it's just incredible. There's, pardon me. You know, excuse me. Oh, no, please, you go first. And people are opening doors.
There's
being
like
so
a camaraderie.
Kind. It's lovely.
There's like a camaraderie.
Really,
but
lovely.
It gets wild in there too. I don't know if you remember the time
course.
That people were like fucking in the bathroom and they refused to stop. They were so like into the show that they went in the bathroom to have sex, and people, they were like, you can't do that in here. And they're like, so? You know,
yeah.
They were just like, no. So it gets wild. But yeah, it's actually one of the things I'm most proud of, is like people have made lifelong friends at my show. People are willing to go alone and buy a solo ticket if they can't get someone else on board, and they go together. We have a lot of couples that come to the show, and a lot of times it's the woman's idea to come to the show. And I've had emails later from the husband or boyfriend that's like, I have had no idea what I was getting into. I was just sort of like going along for the ride. She bought us the tickets, and there I am in the room, is just like filled with this energy, and all these people are dressed to the nines, and I had no idea. And then, you know, and the weirdest thing is the curtains open and she starts welling up with tears, and I'm like, why? This is a strip show. But you know, I just if it weren't for that, those kinds of stories and having like some kind of meaning behind what I do for people, like I can be like that too. Cause like, you know, that's what keeps me going. It's like the fuel for wanting to keep doing shows. You know, people keep saying, oh, you're 46. How long are you going to be doing these shows? And I'm like, well, listen, I mean, I am very inspired by women that are advanced in years from me and how they can keep their eroticism and sensuality. And that's important to me, to see people like Salma Hayek and
absolutely
Gwen Stefani and Jennifer Lopez, like to see them being erotic and sensual in different phases of life. Like that so makes important. Me feel like I need to do that too. And I can't just talk about it. I need to do it too. I need to stand up. Yeah. So that, I think it's, you know, there are a lot of different reasons people come to the show. Some, it has some kind of thing in a parallel in their life and they feel good. I'm not even just talking about me on stage. I'm talking about like the show as a whole is what I'm proud of. Having a diverse cast that represents different kinds of different gender. You know, we have just as many boys in the show as women, and, you know, Dirty Martini and, you know, Gia Genevieve and Zelia Rose. Like we try to, you know, I'm not going to say I'm ticking every box because that's impossible, but, you know, to really kind of change people's minds about what a burlesque show is.
And I think also it's really important for people to understand that sensuality, sexuality can be achieved by anyone, any shape, any form. And it's a state of mind 100%. I think that we've really come mm-hmm. to that conclusion in this conversation. Yeah. So let's verge into, you know, one of the things that thank you for being a guest today on this podcast. This is a really exciting moment because we've done a collaboration together called Scandalwood. Mm-hmm. And we are getting ready to do the re-release of Scandalwood in two new sizes, which we're going to be launching a smaller purse size, which is a 10 ml, and also the new 30 ml size in the new bottle and new packaging. And I really wanted to spend some time with you and talk about Scandalwood. And mm-hmm. then I wanted to talk about fragrance a little bit with you and its meaning. So let's talk a little bit about the collaboration and how it came about.
Okay, let's see. Well, I'm sure you remember, I did four fragrances with a partner in Germany. Right. With each of these fragrances, or maybe not all of them, but especially toward the end, I would, you know, run them past you and be like, what do I tell them in Paris? Because I made the fragrances actually at Fermentation in Paris mm-hmm. when I was living there. And you know, working on the juice. And I'd say like, what do I need to add? What should I add or take away from this to make it what I really want? So I feel like I have this fond memory of us at the sushi bar.
Yes, okay? That's right.
And, you know, giving you the revisions of my fragrance and going, what else can I tell them? Because it was actually at the point where when I was making Erotique, which was the final fragrance I did with them, they basically, when it came to, I'd done three and they were like, we want you to do another. And I was like, well, I don't want to. I don't want to just pump out these fragrances. It's like, I want to make things I want to wear. And I'm more of a signature scent kind of gal, you know, and I don't want to just make commercial fragrances because it started off fragrance number one. They let me do whatever I wanted.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Fragrance number one, I got to do what I wanted. Fragrance two and three, I did not.
Ah.
They were like, oh, let's make it more commercially accessible, which, you know, to me is like flower
boring.
Bombs. I don't want to wear it. You know,
right.
It's just like can't the vanilla, you know, all that stuff. I don't really want to wear. I don't mean
and
to talk. I don't mean to talk shit on vanilla, but you know
but
what I'm talking about. Like they were some of them were sold in department stores and higher end drug stores like Douglas. So they were, you know, a price point like, I don't know, around $30 or something. So they wanted me to do something more commercial for the second too. And I was kind of over it at that point because
right.
I was like, I don't want to do that. I want to go back to like what you let me do whatever I wanted. And so they said, okay, if you'll do one more, we'll let you do whatever you want. And I was like, for real? Really? You'll let me do whatever I want? Because I was a little bit upset because of the third fragrance I did with them. I want to do a Lapsang Souchong fragrance.
Oh, I remember us mm-hmm. having that conversation.
Yeah.
That's right.
And Lapsang Souchong is like a tea, a very kind of polarizing tea for people that don't know, which we are drinking right now in my living room.
Which is delicious.
But it is one
smoky.
Of those things
yeah.
that people like, either they love it or they hate it.
That's true.
So, you know, that's how I feel about fragrance. I love those polarizing fragrances. When I was working in the beauty counter, like the fragrances that were kind of obscure, like Magie Noir by Lancôme.
Yeah.
And that's an obscure one. Elixir, which is a very famous one, but it's still like kind of, it doesn't smell good on everyone.
No, it's
not right for everyone. But when it's on the right person, you're like, whoa, what is that?
Yeah.
Right? Both
no,
of those
it's very
two.
True.
So I wanted to do something like that. And they didn't really let me do what I wanted on that Labsang Souchong fragrance. They kind of like mucked it up in the end, and it had that note in there, but it had a bunch of other stuff that I was like, wasn't what I wanted.
What year was that when you were doing that?
Gosh, I feel like it was, 2008, 2009, 2010, something like that.
And what's funny about that, if you think back to 2008, 2009, mm-hmm. it was around 2010, about 2 years later, mm-hmm. that we saw the birth of all the smoky fragrances that started and people doing Labsang Souchong fragrances.
Yeah.
So again, you were on top of it.
I was. And because I remember even at Vermaniche, which is like this huge perfume house, mm-hmm. they were like, yeah, okay, I guess, mm-hmm. But anyway, don't mean to talk myself up or something, but so I was doing this final fragrance and I was like, I knew that I would be able to do whatever I wanted. So we sat down with that one and I had been working on it for a while and I don't really remember what the final revisions were, but I felt like I got the fragrance of my dreams in that one, mm-hmm. and especially, but listen, was it right for, the drugstore? Maybe not.
Maybe not.
Right. Anyway, so I think, that was when we got together and we talked about when I finished that deal was up and I was like, I don't want to do any more. In Germany, they have a different relationship with fragrance. People buy like 30 fragrances or something.
I think in Europe, the Europeans have a very different relationship with fragrance, for sure.
They like the newest thing all the time and they just want to churn them out. But that wasn't really my thing. So when we talked about doing something together, I really wanted my erotique feeling back, mm-hmm. but I was like, how do we make it better? And anyway, you can speak more to how this is different than erotique in many ways, the quality of the fragrance and whatnot.
Yeah, I think, with this collaboration, when we decided to do this, I've always felt that Dita Von Teese for me is a niche fragrance. And, for me, the idea of niche fragrance is really, it comes back to the idea of artisanal and that it's not made for the masses. Mm-hmm. And, that I really wanted to bring that to light in our collaboration, that this is an artisanal fragrance. And yes, we certainly took all of the cues from Erotique and really tried to pronounce them, tried to emphasize them, make them more impactful, and Scandalwood was born. Mm-hmm. The idea with Scandalwood was that we wanted to create something that was sandalwood centric, mm-hmm. and to take it and give it more va-va-voom. And so you really have a love affair with roses. Do you want to mm-hmm. talk a little bit about your love of roses?
Yeah, I mean, I love rose, but I've never been a rose perfume girl. Mm-hmm. It has to be special, like a spicy rose or some kind of leathery rose. I love the idea of rose. I love the scent of real roses, but perfumes don't usually have that. I used to read a lot of erotica, like vintage erotica, when I was, since I was allowed to read erotica, when I learned how to read, my first book was Anais. I'm just kidding. That would be crazy, right? So I've always thought about like what kind of perfume was worn in Paris in the 1920s and these and I found out when I was researching, there's a great book called Scent and Subversion by Barbara Herman. And her book inspired me so much. And she got me into like collecting decants of vintage perfume because you can collect them like wine and some of them are kept really well. And you can smell what perfume really smelled like in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. And I can tell you, it is so much, and I can tell you, I don't need to tell you, I can tell our listeners, it was more raunchy and dangerous.
Far
and
more
like
raunchy.
A lot of like animalistic notes that you wouldn't, it's not, they didn't wear those clean fragrances. They
pretty.
Had like funk. They were a little mm-hmm. bit funky in a great way. So I've kind of like loved this idea. And that's really what I wanted to get was like, how do we get a little bit of like funk in these fragrances? It's like sexual, it's animalistic, it makes you want more, it's addictive,
highly
but
addictive,
not like clean. Like I never wanted to smell clean. I wanted to smell like when makeup or fragrance, when they meld with your body, like when how makeup can just sit on your face and you look like you have a mask on, or it kind of melds with your skin really nice and it just like looks nice.
Right.
I feel the same way about perfume. It's like I want it to
become part of you
Absolutely. And your it works with your chemistry. And so all these like clean citrusy things, I don't want to smell like cleaning supplies, you know, or fresh and clean. I just showered.
Right.
I want to smell like I, you know, have spent the evening out, you know, it just feels like everything should kind of be lingering on you. Like mm-hmm. the things you did, whether you smoked a cigarette or had a tea or what, you know, the things that you were doing kind of,
in the bathroom.
Yes, the things kind of held on to you and exactly. became part of with your perfume, which may have been a rose. I like heady fragrance that feels like a signature. And I hate when people can clock a fragrance. And I've Absolutely. Always looked for, I love to clock people's fragrances. I mean, I love a whiff of angel when somebody or Maginot, like mm-hmm. these fragrances. I know I love when I smell them on people and I'm like, wow, it smells great. I know exactly what that is. But I always wanted people to be like, what is that you're wearing? So mm-hmm. even when I was in high school, my first fragrance was Quelquefleur.
Ah, such a good one.
Which the only reason I knew about it was I bought like my first strapless bra for prom or something. And there was a sample in it and it spilled and it was all over this bra. And it was like, I couldn't even wear the perfume. I just could smell it on this bra. And I was like, I need that. And then I went in and found out it was really expensive. You know, it was like,
yeah, for the time it was yeah. really expensive.
And, I saved up my money. I probably after I like begged for a few samples or whatever, but saved up my money. I wore that fragrance for decades.
So those for those of you that don't know, Quelquefleur is an interesting fragrance because it was very unique for the time because it was a bit it was citrusy, but it was a like citrusy creamy floral.
Yeah, very creamy and mm-hmm. a little bit powdery.
Yes, a little powdery. Yeah.
I just loved it. It smelled a little bit like I don't know. For me, it just I latched onto it and yeah. I wore it until. It's so funny. I had a French boyfriend in the mid 2007 or 2008 or something. In our first like week of dating, he was like, "Hey, what's that perfume that you're wearing?" You know, because and he worked up the courage to ask me about it, and I was like, "Oh, it's this stuff. You know, it's called Quelquefleur." And you know, I'm in France too. I'm living in Paris, and he says, "My mother wore that perfume."
Oh no.
And I was like, oh, of course she did, because she's fabulous. Like, she was a supermodel, like, in, from the 80s, you know. And I asked my friend Killian Hennessy, who, you know, you know.
Of course.
Perfumer. I said, what do I do? And he said, without skipping a beat, like, you must abandon the perfume or the man. He's like, you have no other option. He's like, it's not pas possible, not possible. You have to abandon one or the other. And I was like, shit. So that was when I created, you know, it's when I was creating my new perfume. So I was like, it gave me a reason to be like making my ultimate fragrance. But it was hard. I had a hard time abandoning because I've been wearing it since I was like 14.
It's a good one. But I'm glad we did Scandalwood. You know, Heretic is known for being a pioneer in the industry for doing the clean fragrance. And, you know, specifically, I work working with naturally derived materials. And I think that people don't realize that Scandalwood is also composed of a high concentration of natural materials, but it is a clean fragrance. And it means that the fragrance is not made with the toxic chemicals that are traditionally found in commercially available fragrances. For the Queen of Burlesque and for Dita Von Teese, how important was it for you to create a fragrance that was clean and non-toxic?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess I hadn't thought about it at first, you know, because I do remember going into the perfume place and they're like, and this is the division where we create flavors, you know, everything is yeah. synthetic. And you're like, wow, they're making the taste for Doritos in there? Like, this is crazy. And it's all chemicals, you know?
It's so terrifying.
I thought about that. And I guess, but I just thought like, oh, I mean, it is what it is, right? There are all these natural perfumes from my understanding at that time was like, oh, they're not legal anymore. Because I'd asked about them. Certainly. I was like, what about civet? What's that? And they're like, oh, you're never putting that in a perfume. But yeah, I guess I didn't used to think about it, but now I think about it a lot more. You know, the same way in my house, I don't use like toxic cleaning supplies, or I look for, you know, body creams and face creams that aren't toxic, that are, you know, not everything natural is good, you know. That's the other thing people should understand.
People need to understand that as well, is that, you know, being 100% natural also comes with issues of allergens and those aspects. But I think that the key point of this conversation is that I think that we're in a time of awareness and mm-hmm. of people should have the ability of understanding what's actually in the fragrance.
Yes.
So sandalwood is an interesting one because I deviated from my typical repertoire of working with only naturals. And I think that only the De Devantis could get me to do this, which was to venture into working with some safe synthetics. Mm-hmm. And I remember very vividly coming to you over and over and over again mm-hmm. with passes and trying to put these, you know, my all natural fragrances in front of you. And you were like, no.
Yeah. I mean, I just think like you do what you can, right?
Yes, of course.
And then there occasionally you're like, oh, I need a little bit of this in there.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we worked
to make it right.
We really wanted to create that sensual aspect and that sexy velvety quality that is driven from musk. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, most musks, natural musks, are taken from, they're an animal byproduct. And the way that they're taken is terrible. And it is... definitely,
we don't want it in our fragrance.
We never want that in our fragrance, and we want to make sure that the products are safe and that they are cruelty-free. Mm-hmm. And so we worked with a safe synthetic, which is a imitation of a musk to create that kind of velvety cord in the mm-hmm. fragrance. So I'm very excited.
Everything
about
in moderation, including your synthetics.
Absolutely. Everything in moderation, that's for sure. So I think lastly, you know, I just would love our listeners to get an understanding of your, to kind of wrap this up and have a fun conclusion. Could you give us one of your most erotic, sensual fragrance memories?
Oh, let me think. I mean, I'm just trying to think erotic. My brain goes to just like fragrance in general. I mean, okay. If I get a whiff of Polo cologne, it takes me right to the back seat in high school. My high school sweetheart wore, you know, Polo. And that, so that pine scent really flicks my switch.
Really?
It does. Like it's so powerful. And so like fragrances like that, I'm like, whoa. And I remember actually being in Paris and the French boyfriend, again, there was this French perfume called Pinot. Do you know this one? It looks like a pine cone, and it's like in a beautiful like glass, like green bottle, like a pine cone, really retro. And it's old fashioned too. And I remember he picked up a bottle and I was like, ooh, I'm right back. I'm 16 again in the back seat of that car. You know, so like I love that fragrance holds those memories, and I love how like some of those like iconic 80s an obsession, you know. I mean, I have a lot of my memories for fragrance that are erotic will come from my, you know, high school years, because, you know, I was getting it on in high school. I had a serious boyfriend for 5 years. Now, I'm not going to lie, you know, I'm grateful for that experience. I had like a really serious boyfriend, and we used to give each other, you know, gifts like a sweater or like a bottle of Obsession, you know.
Right.
That's the first thing that comes to mind.
I love that's a good one. It's a really good, honest scent memory. I love it. Dita, thank you so much for being a part of the podcast. I really want to encourage listeners to log on to hereticparfum.com, check out our collaboration of Scandalwood in its new 30 ml size, which is going to be retailing at the very sexy price of $95, and our 10 ml at $35. And please check out DitaVantis.com for her tour dates. I know that you're getting ready to head off to Australia.
Yeah, and Australia in November, and New Zealand as well for the first time ever. And then I do New Year's Eve here in Los Angeles,
which I'll definitely be part of.
All new show. And then in the spring, I think it's April, May, I have like 8 weeks in Europe, including 3 nights at the Folies Bergères and like 5 nights at the London Palladium. So we're going all over Europe this time. I'm really excited about Folies Bergères. It's really amazing.
That's incredible.
Amazing theater with a lot of history.
So exciting. Well, thank you again.
Thank you.